29, 2003. And members, as we look at our agenda, and for those listening in as well, we're first going to have a hearing on House Bill 3602. Then we have three Senate concurrent resolutions that we will be addressing. And then we will finish up our hearing today with House Bill 3586. And as always, for the members and for folks who are planning to testify on these matters, we, as we have another committee that is in this hearing room 2 hours at 3 o'clock, we do limit our hearings only to this two-hour period. So look for everyone's cooperation to move through their testimony as expeditiously as possible. So let's go ahead and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3602, and we'll ask Representative McPherson to come forward. And did you want Mr. River? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Greg McPherson, representative from House District 38. And I'm here to speak on House Bill 3602, and I'm going to very shortly turn it over to Bill Graper, who's here with me, and who works in the industry that this bill relates to. Just as general background, this is really deals with sort of fine-tuning what is properly regarded as the employment relationship. That is, we have many workers in our economy now who don't work in a conventional workplace, but who freelance and whose services are brokered by others. And this bill just addresses the to make it clearer under state law that people who do handle foreign translation services without working in their own homes with their services brokered through a third party are not the employee of that third party, and that there are no workers' compensation obligations by that employer. With that introduction ended, I'll turn it over to Bill Graper.
Thank you, Chairman Doyle. I'm Bill Graper from Certified Languages International. We're a seven-year-old language service agency serving the needs of customers in about 50 states, I think now, almost all the states. We provide in-person interpreters in the states that we serve for customers like hospitals and courts and lawyers and insurance companies. We also provide over-the-telephone interpreter services where we're connecting somebody who needs interpreter services with that interpreter or with a telephone link. And we also provide written translation services through these interpreters and translators. We had talked to Greg about this exemption because we had been chosen by State Accident Insurance Fund for an audit, who then declared that even though our interpreters were abided by very strict contract terms, they were not going to be exempt from workers' compensation insurance premiums, and declared them to be covered workers of our company. The financial cost was not large, about $2,000, because these interpreters don't earn very much money. It's only about $300. The danger is that SAFIS is chosen to audit, but nobody else is auditing. So there is not a common treatment of this problem across the board. We believe and have already seen some of our industry has already also been audited, and they have been declared to be covered workers for workers' compensation. So this becomes a problem for our industry, and it becomes a problem for these workers, and a lot of bookkeeping for very few dollars. This is the reason that we want to be the 27th exemption under the workers' comp statute, and would hope that we could get this out of committee and get this to the floor.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell us what the basis was for the audit decision that they were indeed covered workers? Was it all over the map, or did it tend to be one set of things? Or?
No, Chairman Doyle and Representative Barnard, thanks for the question. I wish I could answer that. My attorney was supposed to be with us today. He is unfortunately on vacation since this was called at the last minute. It was the administrative law judge found the bulk of the evidence that's presented to be by safe to be accurate and declared that they're labeling them covered workers as accurate. That's all I can tell you right now. I don't have the legislation with me, unfortunately.
Further questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Molly Peters.
Thank you. I really didn't come prepared with any formal presentation, but I am here to back up what Bill Graber said. I am with PTI. My name is Molly Peters. I'm with PTI Global, a 27-year-old company in this state, and we are primarily concerned with translation, the written transfer of language between two languages. And we work, however, the same way Certified Languages does. We contract with hundreds of translators around the world, and they are all independent contractors as far as we are concerned. We do work with them under contract, and that has, you know, been successful through these years. I also do not know why SAFE classified or felt that they needed to classify these independent contractors as employees. They are in no way employees. Question?
Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Let me get that, put this from a different angle if I can. Are these translators considered to be employees for Internal Revenue purposes?
No, they are not.
Thank you.
Nor for the state of Oregon employment. No, not. We've already been through that, and they have been reclassified out of that consideration.
So they pay their own taxes?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, they do.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Great. Thank you for your testimony.
You're welcome.
Let's see. Meg? Meg Reinhold? Let's see if we can have you, if you wouldn't mind, just give us a little testimony about MLAC and, you know, the review process that you go through and how this bill is related to that review.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Meg Reinhold. I'm Senior Policy Advisor to the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I also serve as the Committee Administrator for the Management Labor Advisory Committee. That's a statutory committee created to advise the governor and the legislature on workers' comp system issues. This governor, as the last governor, has made a statement to the committee and the legislature that those bills that MLAC has not reviewed that have a primary system impact on workers' compensation, if they weren't approved by MLAC, then they would be subject to his veto. So we try to take a look at, the committee tries to take a look at workers' compensation bills as they go through, and because it's a little bit outside the system, sometimes people aren't familiar with the system and don't always make it to us. So we haven't actually looked at this bill. We don't have, the committee doesn't have a meeting scheduled in the near future, but that doesn't mean they wouldn't be able to look at this before it gets to the governor's desk.
Has the committee made any or have any position on additional exceptions?
Chair Doyle, members of the committee, there was an additional bill, the session HB 3622, that also allowed for an exception to the workers' comp insurance requirement, and that bill, they voted no on that bill. Excuse me, let me rephrase that. They did not vote on that bill because they didn't have the support for it.
Okay, so is there any I guess, policy issue that the committee has already developed relating to exceptions, or is it that they look at each one individually on a case-by-case basis?
Mr. Chair, I think it'd be accurate to say they look at it on a case-by-case basis, but because the committee, which is made up equally of both labor and management members, really sees workers' compensation insurance as a valuable protection for both the employer and the employee, they generally would discourage any exemptions, but certainly on a case-by-case basis.
Okay. Any other questions? Ms. Reinhold?
Mr. Chair, just comment that the Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee did consider adding another exemption to this statute, and that was passed through our committee. We had also dealt with AMLAC, and they hadn't taken a vote on it. And so, as I told my committee, there are a lot of exemptions here, so it's not without precedent.
Thank you. Representative McPherson, let me bring you back one more time.
Mr. Chair,
given that the testimony from the AMLAC individual, would you have any problem if we went ahead and voted this out, or are you looking to hold it?
I would be pleased if the bill would be voted out as it is, and then I'll have a further discussion so that I can make sure that I put laid to rest any concerns that they might have about what's intended here.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Marhan?
I'm sorry. One more question, and I'm not sure this is the right witness. Whether language translator or interpreter services includes a sign language. I'm getting a nod. Okay. Thank you.
I'll put that on the record. Mr. Graper has indicated that it does include sign language.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Any further discussion? Let's close the public hearing on House Bill 3602, and go ahead and open the work session on House Bill 3602. Discussion? Oh, I guess we need a motion. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3602 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved House Bill 3602 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if this exception isn't overbroad. I mean, I asked the last question I did because of my awareness that there are translators who are essentially full-time with people. Hearing impaired people, and I frankly don't know what the arrangement is for them, but they travel together and are out and about, and I'm just wondering if the exemption might not be overbroad in that respect. I don't have any problem with the idea that someone who's employed sporadically by a whole bunch of different people should not be considered an employee for workers' comp purposes. I have no problem with that, but this other situation came up in my thinking.
Thank you. Representative Moss Anderson?
In reviewing number 27, the language translators, and comparing them to all of the others, especially the one I really liked was the person who performed service as a caddy at a golf course. I like that one. But it seems to fit in with all of the others, so I really have no problem with this one.
Thank you. Other discussion? Representative Berger.
I think that because it's through an agent or a broker, which really sets that aside as far as like a person that's employed full time and everything, I have no problem with this, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Representative Barnhart. That point. Thank you.
Okay. Further discussion? Seeing none, let's call the roll.
Representative
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Close.
Full time.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye, and have 3602 pass with a due pass recommendation to the floor. And we'll ask Representative McPherson, do you want to carry it or consent calendar? Okay. And Representative McPherson, carry this bill. That closes the work session on 3602, and we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 5. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Tom Butler, House District 60. Continue to wear a beef hat as we attempt to regarner some jobs back into rural eastern Oregon. I appreciate your support as we've continued to work in that direction and continue to do an excellent job for jobs and reintroduction of jobs into Oregon. Today, I'm here to testify on behalf of Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 5, which honors former State Representative Denny Jones. Denny was a remarkable man who served Oregon for many years very, very well. In 1998, after 25 years of service and 13 elections to the House of Representatives in the state of Oregon, term limits faced Denny square in the face, and Denny didn't come and recruit me. Some other folks came to recruit me and talk to me about it, and I said at the time, I said, you know, folks, Denny has got such a tremendous reputation and tremendous work ethic behind him, there's no way that anybody could ever fill those shoes. So I recognize that I drink from wells that I didn't dig and harvest from fruit trees that I didn't plant as a result of Denny Jones, the great man that he is. And I went to the ranch, and Denny, at I think he was 88 years old or something at the time, he's in his 90s now, went to the ranch to talk to Denny about it, and he said, why don't you just go ahead and run, and, you know, if I jump back into the race as a result of overturning of term limits, he said, we'll make it a clean race. How's that? And I said, Denny, I'll step down in a heartbeat, because in 1995, he'd served as the co-chair of Ways and Means. 1997, through some skullduggery that happened in the House, he didn't serve as the co-chair of Ways and Means, but he worked always to try and protect the hard-earned dollars of taxpaying Oregonians, and I count Denny as a personal friend, well known to many. I'd like to recognize Denny Jones for his integrity, his experience, his knowledge, and his formidable work ethic, which I'll never be able to match, and even when he's in his 90s, he can ride a horse better than most folks in their 20s. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Butler. Any questions? Okay, thank you. Maybe later we can talk about what you mean by skullduggery in politics. I'm not sure what you mean. Representative
Mr. Chair, he knows where the skeletons are buried. We need to get together.
Roger Martin.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Roger Martin, and I had the honor to serve with Denny when he first came here in the 1970s. He is one of the true characters that's ever served in this body, and I want to share with you just a couple of stories. Denny is almost 90 years old, and he spans some generations that a few of us even remember. He has an eighth grade education at best. On the floor of the House one day, and about 25 years ago, one of Representative Barnhart's constituents, I think, Dave Frohnmeyer, president of the University of Oregon, Rhodes Scholar, graduate of Stanford, Harvard Law School, all the degrees in the world, one of the smartest guys I ever knew, got up to carry a bill from the Judiciary Committee. And he waxed eloquent about what the bill did and how good it was. And he sat down and then he raised his hand and said, Mr. Speaker, would the carrier yield to a question? Certainly. And he asked a question, and a slight frown came across Frohnmeyer's face. He asked some more questions, asked some more. Pretty soon, Frohnmeyer turned to me and says, what'll I do? And I said, you're getting screwed. Just smile and enjoy it. Because Denny read the bill, the whole bill, and there was a huge error in the bill. And they sent it out of Judiciary with that error. And he happily sent the bill back. And the whole floor was uproariously laughing about Dave Frohnmeyer getting shot down by this cowboy from eastern Oregon. He read every bill, and few of us ever did. I don't say that you folks don't, but when you have 30 bills a day, you usually don't. He used to go home every night and read every darn bill, and he would often come and say, Roger, look at the third page of this bill. Well, that is an error. He's just an encyclopedia that way. Wonderful guy. He also, his background, he owned a ranch in eastern Oregon from the early 1930s. He bought it from another Jones and owned it from 1932 until he sold it to the Indian tribe through Bonneville about 3 years ago. Beautiful place. I visited one day, and he took me up in the loft of the barn where the hay was. That year had been a particularly severe winter, and he'd finally gotten through all the hay, and it was down to a layer that he'd put in that barn in 1938. He put that in almost, 30 plus 40 years before, and he said he had it tested by Oregon State University. The nutritional value had dropped about 6% in that period of time. Just throw that in.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Seeing no further names that wanted to testify to this, go ahead and close the public hearing on SCR 5 and open a work session on SCR 5. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Concurrent Resolution 5 to the floor with the adopted recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved SCR 5 to the floor with the adopted recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it's perfectly appropriate for us to pass resolutions remembering deceased legislators. I think it's particularly appropriate after hearing the history of Representative Jones that we approve one while the person we're talking about is still alive. And with apologies to President Frommeyer, I'll vote for it.
Okay. Further discussion? Okay, let's call the roll.
Representative Backlund.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative
Flores. Hold time.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Willis Sanders.
Aye.
Representative Burson.
Aye.
Chair Doyle.
Chair votes aye, and Senate Concurrent Resolution 5 moves to the floor with the adopted recommendation, and we'll have Representative Butler carry that bill. And that closes the work session on SCR 5. And we'll go ahead and open up a public hearing on SCR 4 and ask Sharon Kittle to come forward.
Mr. Chair, I'm Sharon Hill. I live in Portland at 3516 Southeast Alder in Portland. It's in Senator Kate Brown's district. I spoke with Senator Gordley, and she apologizes for her unavailability back behind you. It's a pleasure. I just want to be brief on the record. It's a pleasure to be able to urge your support for SCR 4 for a friend and mentor, and to put on the record the kind of service that Ruth Asher provided as a staff of the Office of Multicultural Health. She traveled the state on the coast through Central Oregon to the real part of Eastern Oregon, working with community-based organizations and with local county health departments about racial disparities in health and how to, get technical assistance, financial support, that sort of thing, and really created a dialogue that was the precursor to what Governor Kitzhaber created as the Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force, which is continuing to operate and work on those issues. You know, my experience, I invited Ruth to join the Oregon Council on Civil and Human Rights, which is advisory to the commissioner, to the Labor Commissioner, because of her work and her knowledge across the state and her reputation on a host of issues. And so she was an advocate. But the last piece I really wanted to remind is that today her, it hasn't been that long ago, she passed away at the end of February. Her daughter, Lisa Moffitt, is here. Her husband, Bernard Asher, is here. Her brother, John Lopez, is here. She was the guiding light for this family. And SCR 4 is a different kind of memorial than what you just finished to honor a great representative, Denny Jones. We need to honor the people that make a difference in the state and provide models for our future and for our future citizens. And so I encourage you to support SCR 4. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions? Okay.
Thank you.
So, seeing no one further to testify on this resolution, we'll close the public hearing on SCR 4 and we'll open up a work session on SCR 4. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Concurrent Resolution 4 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved SCR 4 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any discussion? Let's call the roll.
Representative
Backlund.
Aye.
Representative
Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative
Coates.
Hold time.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Willis
Sanders.
Aye.
Representative Burson.
Aye.
Chair Doyle.
Chair votes aye, and SCR 4 will move to the floor with the adopted recommendation, and we'll have Representative Willis Anderson carry that. And we'll close the work session on SCR 4, and we'll open up a public hearing on SCR 3. Mr. Christensen.
Thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is John Christensen. I am a staff person in the office of Oregon State Senator Mark Carter. The resolution that you have. SCR 3 honors the University of Portland and the women's soccer team, which achieved the national championship this year in Division 1, and also their coach, Clive Charles. Coach Charles, as some of you may know, is currently challenged with cancer, and he's a wonderful gentleman. The women's team is an incredible feat for a small school to have won the national championship, and we thank you for your consideration.
Any questions? Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And anyone further here to testify on SCR 3? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on SCR 3 and open up a work session on SCR 3. Representative Flores?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Concurrent Resolution 3 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved Senate Concurrent Resolution 3 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The pilots really, the women pilots, women's soccer team really did bring a lot of positive media for Oregon, and I enjoyed following them. And I'm very happy that we're going to have this.
Okay. Further discussion? Seeing none. Let's call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Aye.
And chair votes aye. And Senate Concurrent Resolution 3 will move to the floor with the be adopted recommendation. Carrier? Representative Mona Sanderson.
Okay.
And we will close the work session on SCR 3 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 3586. And we'll ask Senator Starr and Representative Hunt to come forward. Well, gentlemen, you've brought a lot of people to our hearing today. I'm curious why that's the case.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. We brought some, and others brought themselves. So please don't hold us responsible for everyone who's here today. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee, for the opportunity to be here. I'm Representative Dave Hunt from Clackamas County, and we have some testimony that will be being handed out to you. We are here to testify in support of House Bill 3586. Because of all the people that are here, I'm not going to go through all my testimony. I would just point out historically that this is an issue that has been particularly prevalent for the last decade and a half. There was a standard within federal and state constitutional law that set a very high standard for states or local governments or federal governments to discriminate against religions. There is a place that you can prohibit the free exercise of religion, but historically it's been a very high standard that had to be met by state or local governments. And that was thrown out with the 1990 Supreme Court case, which basically lowered the bar and made it far easier to prohibit the free exercise of religion. You are probably aware that in 1993, in a very bipartisan way, the Congress, a bill sponsored by Senator Ted Kennedy and Senator Orrin Hatch, kind of may represent the spectrum of federal political life, came together and sponsored the Religious Freedom Restoration Act to restore that high standard again. That passed overwhelmingly in Congress, but 4 years later, the U.S. Supreme Court came back and threw out that standard based on the fact that Congress could not apply that standard to state and local governments. And they didn't rule on the constitutionality of it. They ruled on the fact that that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act could not apply to state and local governments. So since then, states throughout the United States have gone through and systematically been enacting religious freedom protection acts like this, really as a way of saying what's good for federal agencies should also apply to state agencies and local governments, that we should intentionally set a very high standard that if a state agency, if a local government is going to prohibit the free exercise of religion, they should have to meet a very high standard. You'll see in the bill that standard is listed as a clear and convincing evidence test, You'll probably hear some testimony later today suggesting some other wording. I'm not tied to any particular wording. As we had submitted the bill, we had actually suggested some slightly different wording, but legislative council thought this wording was more consistent with the Oregon Constitution. Whatever the wording is, I think we would argue there needs to be a very high standard that if there's going to be a restriction of the free exercise of religion, that a state agency, whether it's the Department of Corrections or some other state agency, whether it's a local government, that they need to meet a very high standard, that the burden should not be on the individual, but should be on the government that is enforcing that. There are probably three things you'll hear today that are primary concerns about this bill. So I might just kind of preemptively lay some groundwork for those. One, I think, is that this bill is not necessary, that there's sufficient protection within the Oregon Constitution as it is. And as I read the Oregon Constitution, we do have a very strong standard protecting religious liberty. However, if you look at the case from 1990, if you look at other circumstances within Oregon, it's clear that we have a problem. And it may be a problem with interpretation, but whether it's a problem with the language in statute or in the Constitution, or whether it's a problem with interpretation, we have a problem and we need some corrective fix. You'll also hear today that this bill will be too costly. I think if you look at either at the circumstances at the federal level, between 1993 and 1997, when the Religious Freedom Restoration Act did apply to states, there were an average of only 3.5 cases per state that were ever initiated, and only 1.5 cases per state that were actually filed. So that just doesn't add up to much of a fiscal impact at all. And if you look at the states that have adopted similar bills just in the last 5 or 6 years, which includes, as you'll see on the goldenrod sheet, Alabama, Arizona, Connecticut, Florida, Idaho, Illinois, New Mexico, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, South Carolina, and Texas have all passed very similar laws since 1997. As we've done research, and Senator Starr may touch on this as well, the financial impacts just don't seem to be there. The biggest question I would ask is, if there are significant costs now, did we realize significant savings since 1990 after the U.S. Supreme Court case? And if so, where are those savings? If we didn't realize savings, then I don't see why we would realize costs today. The last point I'll make is the other argument you'll hear is that this is setting too high of a burden on state and local governments to be able to meet before they can restrict the free exercise of religion. From my perspective, I don't think this is too high of a standard. I think we need to set a high standard, and I think that's part of the Oregon Constitution, that's part of the American Constitution, that people have the right to the free exercise of their religion, and that we as a state need to stand up and protect that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Starr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Starr, State Senator in District 15, here to testify in support of House Bill 3586. A couple of issues that I want to hit on and reemphasize what Representative Hunt talked about is currently we've got 12 states that have passed a Religious Freedom Restoration Act in their state, as Representative Hunt mentioned. Out of those 12 states that have RFRAs, none of them have seen an explosion in litigation against the state. And that really, I expect, debunks the claim that the state of Oregon passing this bill and enacting it into law, that we will see unbelievable costs to state government or to local governments. The compelling interest test that was that we used to have worked well for over 30 years. There was no explosion of religious freedom cases at that time. The consistent application of the compelling interest test in the courts, even the playing field, giving people of sincere religious faith a fair chance against state regulations that violated their religious beliefs. Many times both conservative and liberal religious and civil liberty organizations successfully use the compelling interest test to defend individuals' rights to freely exercise their religious beliefs. And again, we've got 12 states that have formally passed RFRAs. Seven more states through state court presidents have established a compelling interest test independent of the United States Supreme Court's damaging precedents in Smith versus Bernie. None of these states either are experiencing expulsion in the free exercise litigation. Again, where we have a very high standard in religious freedom, we're not seeing this huge number of cases, huge number of amount of litigation. I guess the question is whether or not in the state of Oregon we are going to require state government and local governments to respect to a higher level than we do today the establishment and free exercise of religion or not. I think that it's good policy, the right thing to do, if you're going to burden somebody's religious expression, that you do it under very extreme circumstances, and that is one of the things that quite frankly makes America the kind of nation that we are. And I think I would urge you to listen closely to the testimony and question carefully the testimony that you'll hear today, and I urge you to vote yes on this bill and move it through the process. I appreciate the opportunity to say a few words.
Thank you. Senator Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm State Senator Frank Shields from Senate District 24 in Portland. I don't come with a lot of written testimony, but I come with the experience of 31 years as a clergyman, and then 11 kind of overlapping in the legislature. And I'd just like to mention a quick anecdote. Several of you in 1999, 2000, saw some newspaper articles about the church where I was pastor for 20 years, where we had a feeding program for hungry folks in our neighborhood. The program itself was closed down temporarily by a city hearings officer. That's not the issue. That was opened again, and the church and the neighborhood association were actually given the Spirit of Portland Award for working out a way to make that program work smoothly. But the hearings officer did something very peculiar. When she was ruling on the community dinner, she limited worship attendance at the church. In other words, we had a church that was built for 450 people, and a hearings officer came along and said, "You can only have 70 people in church on Sunday morning." I mean, now obviously that took a city council about 10 seconds to figure out is unconstitutional. But it's just an example of kind of some of the weird things that can happen in our world. And so I guess from my perspective, if something like this bill makes local and state officials stop and think twice before they kind of shoot from the lip, you know, it might be worthwhile. And with that, I'd be glad to sit around and take questions or whatever you want.
Okay. Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the intent of the bill. I want to see people's religious freedom protected. Also, the First Amendment does a good job in saying that no Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise of it. My concern with this bill is that you appear to be limiting the free exercise. And so I want to ask you about Section 1, Subsection 2, Subsection A, which says that it can be done if there's a compelling government interest. And I guess I find that term too broad. I'd like to see it narrowed to what is a compelling government interest. Seems like a huge loophole that you could drive a truck through. So, Senator Starr, maybe you could address that concern.
Actually, the what this bill would do would actually raise the bar that state government would have to meet. Today, we have a lower or less restrictive test that state government and local governments have to meet than a compelling interest test. Not only do they have to have a compelling interest, but they also have to, if you read the sections below that, they have to do it in the least restrictive means of fulfilling that compelling government interest. This bill instates actually a higher legal threshold than is currently established under court precedents.
Follow up. Thank you, Senator Starr. I do appreciate that this does set a higher standard. However, the question was, is there a way to define compelling government interest to make it narrow enough that you don't just include all kinds of things? Is there something in statute that defines compelling government interest?
I don't know that there's anything in statute. My sense is that, and I'm not the attorney at the table, and I don't know that we have one at the table. But I believe that in case law there is a definition of what that compelling state interest would be, and that would be my understanding. If we need to further define that in this bill, I think we'd be happy to work on that without question.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Lana Sanders.
Did you have access to the letter that came from the Office of the Governor?
No. Mr. Chair, Representative Lana Sanders, I just heard as I walked in that had been distributed. I haven't seen it, though.
I'd like to address one issue, one sentence. It says this bill could it's on the second page. This bill could hinder the fair, effective, and efficient application of prison rules, land use laws, laws regarding child and elder abuse and welfare, custody laws, hunting and fishing regulations, rules and regulations in schools and on university campuses, rules and regulations in mental health facilities, laws regarding the compulsory vaccination of children, which I'm very familiar with. A lot of families do not want their children vaccinated, and so they say it's religious reasons because it's easier to say for religious reasons rather than for medical, since you need a physician permission or a signed statement from a physician for medical purposes. They went on to say foster care management, drug laws, anti-discrimination laws, mandatory licensing and registration requirements, rules and regulations governing state employees, and a variety of criminal laws. So there's a huge, huge impact. I think this would be extremely burdensome to the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lana Sanderson, thank you for the question. I think if I were working for a state agency, it would clearly be simpler to be able to restrict people's behavior in a way that didn't necessarily take into account their religious free exercise. So it is accurate that we are trying to impose a high bar, that the burden would be on the state agency or the local government. However, it's important to note that there is an exception in there. It specifically says, unless the public body establishes, and the language in here is by clear and convincing evidence, that application of the burden to the person is essential to fulfill a compelling government interest. For example, within a prison, if there was something that was critical to protecting the safety of guards, protecting the safety of other prisoners, that clearly meets a compelling government interest test. And in that case, the corrections officials would have every right to restrict the free exercise of religion. But they would have to meet that test. They couldn't just say, we're not going to allow yarmulkes to be worn, without meeting the higher standard that there is a compelling government interest.
If I would just respond to that as well, that long list of agencies and programs, to me, that sounds like if this bill... And we're talking about restricting or not restricting the exercise of someone's religion, has that much impact on all of those agencies. From my perspective, it screams for us legislature to act if state and local governments are in any way infringing on an individual's right to practice their religion. And that's a long list of agencies and a variety of programs that you've mentioned there. What is it that state and local governments are doing now that are somehow infringing on folks' ability to practice their religion? That would be my question in response to that long list of programs. The reality is that where states have enacted this, they have not seen, again, they have not seen an explosion in cases. It just hasn't happened. And so where the folks that are concerned about this bill will say, well, it's going to cost all this money. It's going to cost local governments to do all these things. Well, I would say that the that I don't think that the history proves that to be true. And I would question whether or not we are, as a state and local governments, at this point, inhibiting folks' opportunity to practice their religion to the degree that that we would, you know, in that list would indicate.
Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I'm wondering, are we going to hear from perhaps the governor's office or the ACLU, others? I have a series of legal questions. I don't think this is the panel to address them to.
Yeah, there are others.
Okay.
We'll be here.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for this panel? Very good. Thank you, folks. Oh, Representative Hunt?
I could just say one thing in closing. I think the most important thing in my mind in terms of viewing this bill is that this is restoring a standard that was true in Oregon, was true in other states prior to the Supreme Court decision in 1990. So we've got experience from before 1990 that I don't think will demonstrate all the burdens on agencies and local governments. I don't think will demonstrate the cost. We're restoring the standard that was true before 1990, and that's all this bill will do. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Let's see. David Fedanke, you can come forward, please. And members, just for purposes of entering in the record, the letter from the Governor's Legal Counsel dated today from Marlon Sadoff, just as part of the record. And Mr. Fedanke?
Mr. Chair, could I ask Professor Steve Green be allowed to testify now as well? He is much more of an expert on constitutional law related to free exercise of religion.
Okay.
I
since he was listed as neutral on this and you were opposing it, I wanted to get that out of the way first, and then actually I was going to be inviting Mr. Green and I think Mr. Van Valkenburg after you, so
okay.
We might get that neutral perspective.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Fedanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon. And we are opposed to House Bill 3586 primarily because we believe it is unnecessary. I'm certainly not prepared to answer all of the questions that I suspect Representative Barnhart has, but I hope that some of the other witnesses will be able to do that. The case that Representative Hunt referred to, the 1990 U.S. Supreme Court case, was an Oregon case. It's the case of Employment Division versus Smith, which related to the use of peyote by the Native American Church. And that case involved two drug and alcohol counselors who worked down in Douglas County for a private nonprofit drug treatment facility who were members of the Native American Church, and despite the policies of their employer, participated in a peyote ceremony of the church. And the issue was not whether they had the right to participate in that religious exercise, although that was certainly a side issue in the case. The issue was whether or not they were entitled to unemployment compensation benefits. Could the state cut off their unemployment compensation when they were discharged for misconduct, when that misconduct was based on their religious beliefs and their practice of their religion and a core religious practice of the Native American Church? Now, that case had a very circuitous route. It actually went to the U.S. Supreme Court twice. The Oregon ACLU and National ACLU filed friendly court briefs in that case. We filed three different briefs in the Oregon courts and two briefs at the U.S. Supreme Court level. In the end, the U.S. Supreme Court, as has been testified to by the senators and Representative Hunt, throughout the method of analyzing free exercise claims under the Federal First Amendment that have been in use up to that time. And that that test involved situations where a government regulation imposed a substantial burden on a religious practice. And the court had used that standard in a number of cases up until that time. But in the Smith decision, the court instead adopted a new standard which said that a law of general applicability that is neutral on its face towards religion, any kind of a law, it could be land use restrictions, it could be regulations of the corrections department, it could be a criminal statute, it could be any law or regulation, as long as it doesn't single out a religious practice for prohibition, then it's okay, even if it substantially burdens the free exercise of religion. Now, that decision of the U.S. Supreme Court was roundly criticized by everyone virtually outside of the U.S. Supreme Court. It was an argument that had not been made by then Oregon Attorney General Dave Frommeyer. It was not an argument that had been raised at any level of the case in terms of being argued by any of the parties. It hadn't been suggested even by the U.S. Supreme Court during oral arguments. It took everyone by surprise when that decision came down. And so since that time, Congress went through a lot of discussions, dozens of hearings, looking into every aspect of the impact of that decision on government at every level and on religions of all types, both majority religions and religions that were on the fringes of religious practices. And as has been testified earlier, Congress fairly quickly passed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which eventually the U.S. Supreme Court held was unconstitutional. But after that, Congress held more hearings and finally decided in 2000, when it passed what is referred to as our LUPA, that a general restoration of the standard that had been in place prior to the Smith case was unwise. And it limited the scope of this new federal law only to land use proceedings, that is, zoning decisions and other types of land use decisions, and protecting the rights of people who are institutionalized. It decided not to impose that standard on criminal laws. It decided not to impose that standard on all kinds of other governmental regulations, business regulations, all kinds of other things. If this bill is approved, you will be having two sets of rules in every law that you pass. You will have one set of rules for the general public, and you will have a free pass for anyone else who makes an argument that that government regulation violates their religious views. No matter what those religious views are, no matter what religion it is, you would basically be providing a huge exception to every law that is on the books and every law that this legislature might pass in the future. Particularly because the Oregon Constitution has very strong protections for the free exercise of religion, we believe that this statute would be unnecessary and unwise. Article 1, Section 2 of the Oregon Bill of Rights provides that all men shall be secure in the natural right to worship Almighty God according to the dictates of their own consciences. In Article 1, Section 3 provides no law shall in any case whatever control the free exercise and enjoyment of religious opinions or interfere with the rights of conscience. Now that language is very broad, and it hasn't come up in a lot of different cases, but we believe that it would provide and has provided a great deal of protection for religious institutions and individuals in this state, but has not been interpreted to be as broad as this bill that is in front of you today, that we believe would cause a lot of mischief and will keep a lot of lawyers, including government lawyers, busy for many years to come, trying to stay within the bounds of these very broad prohibitions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Ms. Barnhart?
No, I think I'm going to wait for the neutral.
Thank you. Yeah. And we'll go ahead and call Stephen Green and Jeff Van Valkenburg, who are Mr. Green.
Thank you. Chairman Dole, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Green. I'm an associate professor of law at Willamette University College of Law. I teach constitutional law issues, I teach First Amendment law. My specialty is actually religious liberty, separation of church and state issues. I've worked in this area, taught in this area, studied in this area for about 18 years. I've written numerous law review articles on related areas. But more specifically to this particular issue, prior to coming to Oregon 2.5 years ago, I worked in Washington, D.C., and in 1993 got to participate in assisting with the final drafting of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, helped work in its defense by filing amicus briefs when it was challenged, including the City of Burney case, went to the U.S. Supreme Court in 1997, and then subsequently helped draft the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, lovingly called RLUIPA, which is now the current law that exists. And as I noted in my remarks, I also serve on the Religious Liberty Committee of the National Council of Churches. My remarks are my own, though not at Willamette University. I want to make several comments about the advisability of enacting this. I listed myself as neutral on this issue, and I want to make sure that I understand my position, that I do not oppose the idea of expanding protections for free exercise of religion, or necessarily affording some type of statutory remedy for that purpose. I believe very strongly in religious liberty issues and separation of church and state. I have a more nuanced approach to this. My concerns are with the timing of this bill and also with some of the language that is contained in this bill. And so I guess, in all candor, if this is the only bill that you are recommending, then I would oppose it. But I think there are some things that possibly could be done to the bill. First, as someone who teaches constitutional law, law and government issues, legislative-related issues, someone who's worked on Capitol Hill over the years, I don't think you need to pass laws unless they're necessary. I'm not completely sure this law is necessary, even though I'm relatively new to Oregon. I follow these issues rather closely, and I have not seen a compelling need out there to enact this type of remedial legislation.
Can I ask a question about that comment, because we've heard it twice? Thank you. The ACLU also used this statement that this is unnecessary. However, we have a timeline of action by Congress and the Supreme Court on this issue. So I want you to explain to me why it's unnecessary if the federal government and the courts are acting on this and have been for over 10 years.
Yeah. There's a very interesting dynamic that was at work without going into much history. The Supreme Court in 1962, in a case called Sherbert versus Verner, first applied what comes close to a compelling governmental interest standard for free exercise cases. And here we're talking about neutral laws. We're not talking about laws that are directed at religion. We're talking about a law that has a religious discriminatory purpose or specific effect. And so they applied this very protective standard in 1963, reaffirmed it in a couple of other cases in the 1980s. But ever since then, before the Smith decision, the court started stepping back from that rather heightened protection. Not to misconstrue anything was said before, but the Supreme Court has not been consistent in that some 30-some-odd years that it was applying the compelling state interest test at that really heightened standard. It was fluctuating quite dramatically in those decisions. Notwithstanding that, when the Smith decision came down in 1990, there was a visceral reaction to this. And the visceral reaction was, eek, the sky is falling. This is terrible. We have had pre-exercise protection, and everybody saw that as being some kind of monolithic thing that had existed without any variations, which is not accurate.
Professor,
and so there was a rush to bring this out.
I think you're proving my point that that's why it's necessary to do something like this.
It's not necessary to do something just because the law changes. And the Supreme Court changed its view of the First Amendment in 1990. And many people were concerned, and I was very concerned at the time. I still am concerned that the way the Supreme Court went about doing it was incorrect. As I said, my comments here today are that possibly the standard that is being applied here is unnecessary and inequitable. But then also, if there are other existing media out there, then it may not be necessary for Oregon to institute this. And my primary point is when this went back to Congress in 1997, 1998, when I testified in Congress on this matter, we were searching for examples of free exercise violations to help bolster the record, because this is one of the things that the court said in the City of Bernie case, that we didn't have enough evidence to support the necessity of this bill. And what we primarily found were situations dealing with land use and then people who were institutionalized, prisoners. Those were where, I can't even give you a statistic, but 90-some-odd percent probably of the cases that we saw came within these two particular areas. So that's why the Religious Liberty, the Religious Land Use Institutionalized Persons Act was enacted, because that's where Congress saw the primary concern. My point is that act exists. That act is applicable to Oregon. That act covers land use regulations in this state as well as it covers the prisons in this state. And so my point is, I'm not necessarily sure why we need an additional bill here if the ground is covered.
Representative Close?
Thank you, Mr. Chair Paul. I understand that you are opposed to this bill. However, I'll just use one example of the land use problems down in Eugene, where you had the situation with the cross that had to be moved. It was a World War II memorial, I believe. I'm just saying, it seems to me that to say that this is unnecessary shouldn't even be debated. We do have a problem in Oregon, I think.
Well, Representative Coates, I must disagree with that. The Skinner Butte cross situation was public property, and it was a public display. And so consequently, that was the establishment of religion issue. There is no free exercise base for me getting the government to put up a cross or a menorah or whatever religious symbol I wish on public property. There's just no free exercise claim for that.
Mr. We can disagree on that, but my point is it's unnecessary. That's what I'm driving at here.
Well, I guess the point I'm trying to make is I think that the law may serve a purpose if there was a substantial evidence out there showing that the current state of the law is not satisfying the need, is not protecting the interests. And I'm open to see cases to support that, but I have not seen that many. And like I said, what we saw in Congress in our experience was is the vast majority of incidents seem to fall under the categories of land use and institutionalized persons. We have a federal law that's been in force since 2000 that covers those situations. And so the question I'm just asking is there a necessity for an additional overlay of an Oregon law when it seems like the ground is covered? That's my first
Mr. Chair, a comment. 25% of the states are passing these. So I just think that should be on the record that it is of concern to at least 12 other states.
Thank you. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I'd like to hear the rest of what you have to say, but I'm wondering if the provisions of the Oregon Constitution that Mr. Fedanke referred to don't apply to this discussion as well as what the federal government may have done.
The Oregon Constitution, Sections 2 and 3, are much broader, much more specific than the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. So their language would seem to cover these situations. Now, the Oregon courts have traditionally followed the lead of interpreting their constitutional provisions as the U.S. Supreme Court has in this area. And so if the Supreme Court has lowered the standard, we don't have that many cases in Oregon. but the very few that I could find, it appears that the Oregon Supreme Court is following the lead there. And so I'm not sure how much additional protection you necessarily get from the Oregon Constitution. But what it requires, though, it requires someone to bring a case and establish that in the law, because Oregon also does have a tradition of interpreting its constitutional provisions separately and more protectively. The problem with the Employment Division case in 1990 was it was litigated under federal standards, not under state standards. So the Oregon Supreme Court was ruling on a federal constitutional interpretation, not the state. I mean, and I would invite ACLU, which has some of these cases, and any other organization out there, to bring these cases in state court and establish that state law into state constitutional law.
Okay. Have there been cases in Oregon, then, in which the Smith standard has been adopted? Or have we just not had cases yet?
I have not seen that many cases. My understanding is the Employment Division versus Smith, when it went back on remand, the court here, the court, state courts here, then went along with the United States Supreme Court standard, but of course that was under a federal standard. There is at least one 1990.
So if I may, Article 1, Section 2, and Section 3 of the Oregon Constitution were not litigated in that case.
We're not litigating that case. It's a 1995 case where apparently the Oregon Supreme Court applied a lesser standard than the higher heightened compelling interest standard. But beyond that, there really has not been a lot of litigation.
I'm sorry, I missed the reference.
There's a 1995 case where the Oregon Supreme Court applied apparently a lesser standard to this for an anti-discrimination situation. But generally speaking, it just has not been that actively litigated here.
One more, if I may. Do you plan to talk about the issue that Representative Post raised, the issue of the meaning of the term compelling government interest? Is that part of what you plan to talk
yes.
about? Okay, then I'll be quiet, my panelists.
I believe that the current version of this statute, at least I find it a little bit problematic, because some of the language it is using in the bill itself. First, just let me say that I think this is standard that it's applying is the incorrect legal standard, because it may be very onerous for governments to follow. This is very comprehensive in its sweep. Like the Governor's Council states in her letter, you have to realize this has both breadth and depth. It applies to every single level of government. It applies to every single type of regulation, policy, practice that may exist. And she gives kind of a laundry list of the types of enactments that this would apply to. The other thing to remember is this is, we're talking about neutral laws, laws of general applicability. And what that means is these are not laws that are directed at religious practice. These are laws that just apply across the board to every single person. But when someone has a religious claim, they then can get some exemption from the law if this law would be applied. What this establishes, as I said, is strict scrutiny, which is the most demanding level of government justification that we find in the law. It's an extremely high level of justification. As the courts have often called it, they call it strict in theory but fatal in fact. In essence, it's almost impossible for the government to justify its actions by the compelling governmental interest standard. The problem I have with this is not only is it a high standard, I actually think an intermediate standard would be more applicable. It also sets up an inequitable standard, I believe, between religious discrimination and other forms of discrimination. Once again, we're talking about neutral laws, not laws directed at religious discrimination. Because under gender discrimination, when there is purposeful gender discrimination, we judge that by what we call intermediate scrutiny. It is not by strict scrutiny. So here you're going to have less protection for directed intentional discrimination against gender, but you're going to have a higher scrutiny for unintentional discrimination against religion. That sets up a disconnect in the law. And maybe being a law professor, we're concerned about these things. But in essence, as I put in my testimony, under free speech and under equal protection, there is less protection that's provided there. Now, that may beg the question whether we need more protection or not, but I think that the appropriate standard should be what we see in free speech. When you have a law that is neutral on its face and is not directed at religion, that we apply this intermediate level of scrutiny, as I put out in my testimony.
Representative Monis Anderson.
I have a question trying to relate how this bill would affect things that have happened in the past. For instance, in Oregon City, there's a religious sect that believes firmly in the power of prayer, and there have been several deaths with children and the DA felt strongly that they needed to be prosecuted because of the deaths of these children, which should have had, in the DA's, I shouldn't speak because she may have had other reasons, these deaths could have been prevented. How does this law affect something like that? I guess I'm trying
well,
to...
Well, this law would provide a very high standard. It applies to every law, so it would apply to criminal laws, too. So, in essence, it would be that you would need to show that there's a compelling reason for the enforcement of the law against these people because they have a religious belief that motivates this particular action that they have. Now, I think the state can most times find a compelling interest in the protection of children. I don't think that really has been much of a question in the past. In most instances, that would be the most narrowly tailored way to go about doing that. So I think when we're talking about criminal statutes, when it comes to the protection and well-being of children, those could still be enforced notwithstanding this type of statute. But there are a host of other types of potentially less threatening situations. Child endangerment, you can go down the list to lesser and lesser types of endangerments, where the state may not have quite as compelling an interest to intervene, or at least to intervene in the manner that it is doing so. The issues...
If I can just get you to wrap up, because I what you can do is summarize your written testimony, what you have remaining, just because we have a huge number of people still wanting to testify.
Let me just make a couple of technical points. Irrespective of what I'm asking the committee to do to reconsider and to come up with a different standard that applies here, you do need to understand that the standard that is in this language actually is inaccurate as reflecting what the Supreme Court held between 1963 and 1990. The term was substantial burden, not burden on religion. The Supreme Court never spoke in the language of just a pure burden. It meant substantial. That's a term of art in the law. It's very important. If you enact this law, you're going to be going back and looking at cases to know how to interpret that term. That needs to be changed. Secondarily, only in one case did the court, so far as I can tell, ever use this least restrictive means standard. It usually uses the term what we call narrowly tailored, and I realize these are very technical terms, but these mean a lot in the law, and that is something that I think should be addressed. Third, as I mentioned in my final point, there are concerns about the application of this law when we're applying to religious institutions that may not be engaged in what we would normally consider the central points of a practice of religion. Many are engaged in businesses. This would have the potential for exempting religious institutions, potentially, from some anti-discrimination laws. That's just something this committee needs to be aware of, understand the ramifications for these types of this type of legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Chair Doyle, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Van Valkenburg. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Department of Justice. I have a poll that's been hanging on for over a week, so I apologize if I'm not as clear as I might have been otherwise. I'm here today to present some testimony on behalf of the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice is neutral on this bill, but has concerns both with some of the language in the standards, much of which the professor has alluded to, also with the fiscal impact that the Department of Justice anticipates will flow from the language, the very features of the way that this bill is written. I have provided the committee with Attorney General Meyer's letter to Chair Doyle. In the letter, Attorney General Myers notes that this is the third time in as many sessions that we've seen a similar religious liberty bill come up for consideration. Attorney General Myers has in the past written letters to the committee chairs that heard those bills, and the concerns and effects and impacts that he identified in those letters, he and the Department of Justice believe are similarly applicable to this bill. Also, at the end of that packet, you'll see DOJ's fiscal statement for your consideration. Much as the governor, legal counsel stated in her letter, Ms. Sathoff, Attorney General Myers has identified and the Department of Justice has identified a number of areas of public policy administration that the language in this bill would potentially have a very significant impact, including the administration of state and local correctional facilities, higher ed policies, education issues, environment and land use, transportation, criminal justice, and also child protection and welfare. The reason that these impacts have such a significant potential for impact is because of the language in the bill. And if I might echo a little bit of what the professor had to say, this has a very broad definition of religion, of exercise of religion. Protected religious exercise is defined in the bill to include essentially any religiously motivated belief or practice, even those that are not mandated by or central to a system of religious belief. In contrast, at least for First Amendment purposes, the Ninth Circuit has ruled that the First Amendment provides protection for centrally applicable religious belief or mandated by faith. The RLUIPA, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, that both Mr. Fedanke and, I'm sorry that I forget your name,
Green.
Mr. Green, spoke to, has a higher standard than the First Amendment. It provides a similar definition of religious exercise, but as far as the First Amendment goes, this is more expansive. This bill, as written, has a broad definition of burden for the same reasons that Professor Green indicated. The law, even in the RLUIPA, is and in the prior federal statutory law, was substantial burden. This provides protection for any government action or regulation that has the effect of inhibiting or curtailing in any way a proper religious exercise, even in substantial burdens. One of the more unique features of this bill, I think, is that it would also put on the government a very high level of proof, a standard of proof, to come back and justify its actions, not only under the compelling state interest at least restrictive means test, but also by a clear and convincing standard of proof, which in the civil law is as high as we see. The normal standard of proof in a civil case is preponderance. Here the government's put to a much higher burden apart from the legal standard of the strict scrutiny. Another interesting feature of the language of this bill is that it would require that the state and the government, local governments, prove their actions are essential to fulfill a compelling or very important governmental interest. Under the federal statute, the RLUIPA, what is required is that it be in furtherance of one of these very important governmental interests. So this, again, heightens the legal standard the government must go through. And then finally, this bill creates a new private right of action for damages and attorney's fees, essentially a cause to sue state and local government that doesn't exist in current state law. And that provides at least some incentive. I work on the correction side of the street. I'm the general counsel contact attorney in the Attorney General's office for the Department of Corrections and have been for a number of years. And so my experience with religious liberty laws is primarily with prisoners. And I hate to think about what a new incentive in state law might, what this might do in getting the inmates out of federal court and more into our state courts. As a result of these...
let me stop you there.
Yes.
Can you clarify that again? I mean, they're already doing this in the federal court, so this would just move it to the state court, or it would...
Chair Doyle, members of the committee, the RLUIPA expressly covers state and local inmates, other institutionalized persons, including mental hospital patients and confined juveniles. So the Department of Corrections in Oregon and every other state right now is meeting, or at least is required by the law to meet under the federal law, this compelling state interest least restrictive means test. And we litigate those issues now. Under the federal law, they can obtain damages for a violation of their rights, although there's a restriction if there's no physical injury to the inmate under another congressional act called the Prison Litigation Reform Act. But yes, there are existing remedies for inmates and other institutionalized persons under federal law, which is the RLUIPA. As a result of these potential legal effects, Attorney General Myers and the Department of Justice have attached a very substantial fiscal to this bill. And I think the estimate is that it's an average close to $700,000 per biennium, and that principally as a result of the need to hire additional, the anticipation of hiring additional attorneys to cover the advice needs of state agencies and officials, and to defend expected litigation that we would see over the uncertainties of the law as well as the expected increase in litigation we would see from these higher standards. The last point that I'd like to make, and it's not a point that the professor made, and he might want to comment on it, is right now in the federal courts, we're seeing the RLUIPA challenged across the country under the Establishment Clause and some other federal constitutional provisions. The Ninth Circuit held in December in a prison case out of California in a case called Mayweathers versus Newland that the RLUIPA did not violate the Establishment Clause or other constitutional protections. The state of California is now preparing its petition to have that re-examined or reviewed by the U.S. Supreme Court. There are two federal district court cases in the last 3 months, one out of Wisconsin, one out of Virginia, which strike down the federal standard, the RLUIPA, under the Establishment Clause. The Virginia case is on its way, if it's not already there, in the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. So there is a possibility, maybe even a likelihood, that this issue, at least at the federal level, might be examined by the U.S. Supreme Court next term. Certainly, you know, the argument that's made under the Establishment Clause essentially is this, as I understand it, that the RLUIPA affords such heightened protection to religious exercise while excluding other equally fundamental rights from strict scrutiny of review. And the strict scrutiny of review is this compelling state interest, least restrictive means test that we've heard discussed today. What the folks are saying when they're challenging this under an Establishment Clause basis is that this has the primary effect and the principal effect of government impermissibly advancing religious belief. I can't tell you, my office can't tell you how these courts are ultimately going to rule on the issue, but at the very least, I think we can anticipate there will be litigation over it and there will be costs associated with that. And that's what I have.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff, I was hoping to go back to your comment about the attachment of the $700,000 fiscal. I know that the 1999 Supreme Court decision that struck down the previous interpretation has been discussed many times. Now, can you tell me, have there been savings to the Department of Corrections since the 1999 Supreme Court decision?
Chair Doyle, Representative Backlund, members of the committee, the City of Bernie case was in 1997, and the RLUIPA came into effect in 2000. Frankly, some of the issues in the corrections area were litigated under the prior RFRA standard that came into effect in 93. So, for example, one of the hot issues in the prisons in this state and some other states is should an inmate be allowed to conduct and lead and facilitate their own religious service or group worship in a prison, closed prison environment. We successfully defended that case under the RFRA some years ago under a similar compelling state interest least restrictive means test. As far as identifiable savings during the time period you're talking about, I'm unclear about that. I don't know.
Follower. Yeah, Jeff, I guess my point is I would have to question the attachment of a $700,000 fiscal based on other testimony I've heard in that very few cases of litigation have been recorded in other states. So I understand this $700,000 fiscal involves three people. If there is no evidence that you'll have a lot of cases in the Department of Corrections, it would seem, therefore, logical to assume that $700,000 is not a reasonable figure. It's too high.
Chair Doyle, Representative Backlund, members of the committee. I guess, first of all, I understand that I'm not personally involved in the preparation of the fiscals, but also understand that the impact and effect of this bill is as broad-ranging as you could imagine. It affects and impacts any governmental action that's asserted to burden religion in any way. So we're talking about all the other areas as well of government, education, transportation. The two cases that most recently have come up, of which I am aware, one is a land use case involving a church's plan to expand in or around Highway 205 in Clackamas County. And the church asserted that it had the legal right to proceed and expand without paying for the infrastructure improvements to the highway, and to impose those costs on the church would substantially burden the churches and the members' exercise of religion under the federal law. Under this kind of standard, where we discuss these features of this bill which go beyond the federal standard, we would see, I think we would see, a likelihood of even more litigation in those areas and any number of other areas. So I guess my testimony, Representative Backlund, is that I don't think that this is an insubstantial fiscal. I think that it's based on our best information in the Department of Justice about what we anticipate the fiscal impact to be. And I understand the prior testimony, but the wording of this bill is so broad that I don't think we can do anything but anticipate that we would see litigation in all sorts of levels. And at the very least, you know, just part of the Department of Justice's role is to defending its litigation. Much of what we do is proactive. I'm a general counsel attorney. My job is to try to keep my clients out of court. And to wind our way through the sort of the vagaries and the difficulties of these sorts of features of the bill, I think, will require significant general counsel legal advice as well as litigation defense.
Follow up?
Jeff, thank you very much. And you'd say this, even though, as I understand it, 12 other states have had little experience in terms of, much higher fiscals.
Chair Doyle, Representative Backer, members of the committee, I personally am unaware of the wording of those state statutes in the other states where they've enacted similar religious liberty legislation. What I can tell you is I've never seen, and this is something I look at from time to time because of my impact and advice to the prison officials, I've never seen a bill with this kind of loading of burden on state and local governments. Now, whether they do that in other states, I couldn't tell you. But this seems, there are several features of this bill that go quite beyond what the existing federal law or whatever it was.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. This is really by way of a follow-up, I think. If the bill were to be amended along the lines raised by Professor Green, that is changing the standards requiring a substantial burden, requiring a significant or important government interest rather than a compelling government interest, if the least restrictive language was changed to narrowly tailored language, that sort of thing, and that obviously there are a number of places in the bill where those changes would have to be made. Would that change your view of the fiscal, or would the same issues that you're concerned about now still apply?
Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, members of the committee, sure it would change it. To the extent that you're lowering the standard where we would expect less litigation in all areas of government, we would expect that some of those costs would go away. The extent to which they would, I can't tell you. I think the difference in part is that this is still, unlike the federal RLUIPA, is a law that would apply to any government regulation or action at any level. And so we don't have that right now. We have just the constitutional protection plus the federal statutory RLUIPA. So that in and of itself will generate, I think, requests for advice at all levels of government from their council, and certainly additional litigation in areas that we don't see protected to the same standard under the federal statutory law.
Okay. Yeah. And I want to, if I may, I'd like to switch topics just slightly and follow up on a different one.
Okay. Given the time considerations and the number of people still to testify, if you want to finish up with one question, I'm fine with that, but we're going to have to move on.
Okay. If we were to make the changes that the professor has suggested, would we have a law which would be significantly different than the standards we now understand the courts to apply under the constitutional provisions? And would it meet this balance test that you were dealing with a few minutes ago?
Chair Doyle, Representative Barnhart, members of the committee, I'd actually feel somewhat more comfortable having the professor address that question. But if I...
Yeah, maybe I should ask
it. But let me comment. Actually, I'm losing my train of thought. I apologize. Could you restate your question?
Well, I'm wondering, if we made the amendments that we were just discussing in the other context,
would it
restate?
Would it be higher than the existing federal constitutional standard?
Or what's the federal and state? Because after all, we're in Oregon, we're concerned about both standards.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I can't speak with any authority about what the level of protection that the state constitution is providing. Most of the litigation experience I've had in advising corrections officials is on the federal side. But I understand, as does the professor, that to the extent that the state Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals have addressed the religion clauses on the Oregon Constitution, they have tended, at least in the past, to follow the federal lead. Now, if I understand your question correctly, no. The types of intermediate scrutiny standards that the professor suggests might be an option, a policy option for this committee and for this body, would increase protection from the existing Smith standard under federal constitution and the First Amendment. Because right now, the First Amendment provides that a law that isn't aimed or targeted to restrict religious practice, which is neutral to religion, a law of general applicability, the Supreme Court has said they're not going to allow that to be interpreted in such a way that persons can carve out an exception from those generally applicable laws because of religious exercise. Is that a fair statement, Professor?
Thank you. Okay, I appreciate your testimony, and like I said, we do have others to move on to, and members with that's about 50 minutes of statements in opposition to this bill, and so I'm going to move to those who are for the bill, and recognizing that there's probably about five folks still in opposition. If we have time to take that testimony, we'll take it before 3 o'clock. If not, like I said earlier, we will still conclude at 3 o'clock. So to do that, then, let's ask Greg Hamilton and Greg Sneller and Bruce Fitzwater to come forward. And while they come forward, members, there was additional written testimony provided by the legislative liaison or analyst from the city of Eugene, who provided written testimony for your benefit. And I would state, too, that those who we do not get to by 3 o'clock, if you have written testimony, we will enter that in the record as well. Mr. Hamilton.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Greg Hamilton. I come from Portland, Oregon, and I work for the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And we have 90,000 members in the Northwest. It covers five states and in this region. And as the Northwest Religious Liberty Association, which is the government relations division of our church, we come here strongly supporting House Bill 3586 for several reasons. Number one, what's wrong with a bill that takes the burden of proof off of the shoulders of individuals and institutions of faith and puts it back on the state, which is basic common sense in any court of law? When you come into court of law, shouldn't the burden of proof be on the state, not on the individual? It seems like with the compelling state interest test, we have a standard here that's fair to individuals of faith and institutions. And that's really what we're talking about here, is the issue of fairness. We are mindful of Seventh-day Adventists of the fact that the Supreme Court's decision in Sherbert versus Verner in 1963, which mirrored the Oregon versus Smith case of 1990, specifically involved a Seventh-day Adventist church member who had been discriminated at her place of employment on the basis of her firmly held beliefs. We take special interest in the fact that it was in this particular case that the High Court ruled that the state's interest in denying unemployment benefits merely because Mrs. Sherbert would not make herself available for work on Saturday, her Sabbath, as required by the state's unemployment compensation law, was insufficiently compelling to warrant an infringement upon this most fundamental right, the free exercise of religion. And so that's the primary reason we're interested in this. The secondary reason is because of the practical need. We don't believe that restoring the compelling state interest test in the least restrictive means unnecessarily gives religion a superior advantage to any other individual in the public square. We believe that it just merely restores the right of religious peoples, what we believe as Seventh-day Adventists, along with other peoples of faith, that religious freedom is America's first freedom, but nevertheless, it doesn't make it necessarily superior to any other civil rights or civil right issues. We just want an equal place on the bus, so to speak. And so that's our primary concern. There are several practical issues involved with this bill that I think would be helpful. It's been often asked, it's legitimately asked, people wonder if there's actually a real need for an Oregon Religious Freedom Act. After all, it is true that most of us are not daily confronted with overt religious discrimination. But this is not proof that some faith groups are not experiencing real difficulties. News stories of churches closed down by zoning laws or being prevented to add on to their church property because of historic preservation laws or growth management acts that exclude the building of private religious schools and churches or of non-denominational religious groups zoned out of entire neighborhoods for conducting small group Bible studies in homes or of worship and soup kitchen feeding programs being forced to close down as in the Sunnyside Centenary United Methodist Church back in 1999, just a few years back. And including being arbitrarily told that they could not have more than 70 in attendance on any given Sunday for worship. These are real concerns to us. And we believe that the free exercise of religion is something that is one of our oldest traditions in America that we cannot afford to lessen in any way. And so the compelling state government interest, compelling state interest test, we believe, is something that would merely provide religious peoples an equal standard, not necessarily a higher standard than other people.
Thank you. Let's see, Mr. Sniller.
Chair Doyle and committee, I'm the pastor of Calvary Baptist Church here in Salem.
You can identify yourself for the record, please.
Greg Sniller.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm here in support of the act, also House Bill number 3586. I'm here as just as a local church pastor, concerned about freedom and the right of houses of worship and places to determine the ministry directions in which they feel called to serve and to be in their particular community at a particular time. Of course, this creates a problem, but it's a problem that I would rather live with than squelch, because you know people do get upset about things that different houses of worship do. Neighbors may not like it, but I do believe that we should allow the right of houses of worship to determine ministry directions and not have the majority, a city council, a judge decide, you know, what particular places of worship do. In 1998, Senator Orrin Hatch said about the Religious Liberty Protection Act, he said that one of the reasons for it was to ensure that in America Bible study would not be zoned out of believers' own homes and their places of worship not zoned out of their neighborhoods, and to ensure that the founders' free exercise guarantee will at least mean that government will have a good reason before it outlaws or punishes a religious practice. In that same hearing, Senator Edward Kennedy said in the years after the Smith decision, before the passage of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in 1993, we often saw restrictions imposed by state and federal laws on an individual's right to the free exercise of religion. Churches were zoned out of commercial areas, Jews were subject to autopsies in violation of their faith, Jehovah's Witnesses were denied employment after refusing to take loyalty oaths. I believe today that you have an opportunity as you work with this bill to continue doing what we have a rich history of, and that is allowing people the right to free exercise of religion, and only in extreme circumstances should we ever interfere in that. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Fitzwater.
Thank you, Chairman Doyle. My name is Bruce Fitzwater. I do community relations with the Christian Science Church in Oregon, and I've been in its ministry for 30 years. And being raised in Oregon, living in Portland most of my life, I certainly have noticed a change in the religious community over that period of time. And today I'm an active member of interfaith groups in Oregon that I didn't even know, it probably didn't even exist 30 years ago when I was in high school, at college 40 years ago. And what I'm thinking about here is I'm just going to speak from a sort of a personal standpoint. As legislators, you're making laws all the time, and as we heard in the hearing for one of the House concurrent, Senate concurrent resolutions, that often you're not even reading everything is in there. Even someone as close to interfaith community as I am, I don't know what the effect of all of these laws are going to be on those communities. And I know that those communities are not down here watching those laws all the time coming through. We've seen how uncertain and how unknowing we are even about our First Amendment in our Constitution in Oregon. We're told that, well, it'll probably follow the Oregon or the state federal courts. We don't know. Living in uncertainty is not peace. What I feel is that I don't understand fully all of the legal requirements, whether it's substantive or burdened or whatever. I can see amendments. But I do know that if you pass this legislation, you're going to be, I think, bringing a greater sense of peace to this state. I think you're going to be saying something, I hope from your heart, to the members, the citizens of this state, saying, we respect you. We don't want to step on your toes. We don't want to restrict your life. We may not even understand you, but we set ourselves as a legislature to listen and to try to prevent ourselves from unnecessarily, now again the language is going to be complicated here, burdening you. We want you, even though we don't understand you or even know you're there, to feel that you are full citizens of this state. That's our intention. And I think that is a root shining light, if you want to mix the metaphors here, for what America is and what Oregon is. I think more people are going to be feeling harmonious in this state, Muslims, Buddhists, I don't even know who they're going to be, if they know this is your principle.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimonies. And let's see, Paul Cosgrove and Bob Castagna. And as they approach to members, just to identify the written testimony from the League of Oregon Cities, Christy Monson, and also from the City of Portland, enter as part of the record. Mr. Cosgrove.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I appear today here as a volunteer. I am the chancellor, which means the attorney for the Oregon-Idaho Annual Conference of the United Methodist Church. I'm also privileged to have four of my law partners as members of the Courts of Appeals and Supreme Court in the state, and I'd like to just pass on one message from one of them who we were working on religious freedom issues before he was appointed to the court, and he mentioned to me, I doubt he could make that same statement now given he needs to follow that precedent, that he thought the Smith case, which after all this whole issue did start in Oregon, was one of the worst cases, worst decisions of our state Supreme Court on religious freedom issues, and unfortunately it was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. I also had the privilege last Friday and Saturday to attend a meeting of the chancellors of the United Methodist Church from all over the country, and at that meeting the General Counsel of the Roman Catholic Church in the United States spoke, my General Counsel spoke, as well as the General Counsel of the Mormon Church, all about this issue and about the importance, given the status of the law, of states taking the lead in adopting religious freedom restoration acts. My brief comment would be my understanding of the legal position, and I was also, as Senator Shields mentioned, the Sunnyside United Methodist Church, I was the attorney involved in that dispute with the City of Portland, and we reached a political decision at the City Council that we were looking at, would we be able to prevail if we had to go to court. Oregon has a stricter standard for free speech than the United States Constitution, Oregon's Constitution does. We have a standard for religious freedom that has dropped down to the level of the federal protection for religious freedom. And so, in fact, what we have happened is an erosion of rights of religious freedom since 1990. In that case, that came out of Oregon. But this bill, I think, with the appropriate amendments, which Mr. Castanga will talk about, will take a position where we were here from 1963 to 1990. The Smith case dropped us down to here. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act passed by Congress moved us back up to that same level. The Supreme Court dropped us back down, and Congress has now moved us back up, but only in two areas, land use, and corrections. And what this bill, with perhaps a few clarifying amendments, will do is simply return us to the same place we were from 1963 to 1990, and temporarily, while Congress had adopted and before the Supreme Court overruled the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, where we were for those few years in 1990, late 1990. So we would support the bill. I think there are a few amendments that need to be made to conform, and I think they will substantially address the fiscal impact issues, conform this to the language used in the federal bills. As we all know, when we submit ideas to legislative council, they sometimes come back with small wording changes. Sometimes those small wording changes are important, and I think the Attorney General has pointed out that some of those may cause unnecessary problems in your efforts to bring us back up to that level where we were between 1963 and 1990. So we would request that you support the bill with the kind of amendments Mr. Costanga was described. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Costanga.
Chair Doyle, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Costanga representing the Oregon Catholic Conference. I had the chance to review the letter which the committee members received from the General Counsel, Office of the Governor, about a half hour before the hearing was slated to begin. And then I reviewed the language of the letter from the Governor's office and the language of the bill with the Office of General Counsel, United States Conference of Catholic Bishops in Washington, D.C. And they are suggesting that we amend the bill along certain of the concerns that you heard previously expressed. For example, number one, in the definitional section, that we insert a definition of the word demonstrates, and we will use that word demonstrates later on in the bill, such that demonstrates means the burdens going forward with the evidence and of persuasion, such that the evidentiary standard would be one of a preponderance of the evidence rather than, as you see in lines 13 and 14, establishes by clear and convincing evidence. So that is at least reducing government's burden of evidence. Secondly, in line 12 of the bill, a public body, the language, a public body may not burden. Insert the word substantially burden before burden. So again, reducing the burden on government. In line 13 and 14, delete the words establishes by clear and convincing evidence, and insert the verb demonstrates, so that it reads, unless the public body demonstrates that application of the burden to the person is. Then in line 15, instead of essential to fulfilling a compelling government interest, insert the word in furtherance of a compelling government interest. Then B, line 16, the least restrictive means of furthering the compelling government interest rather than fulfilling. And then in line 20, if a public body, instead of burdens, insert the word substantially burdens. With those amendments, the bill would attempt to be conformed to the language of the federal statute, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which, even though found unconstitutional as applied to the states in the city of Bern versus Flores case, RFRA is still valid and constitutional as applied to the federal government. So that what we're trying to do here, as Mr. Cosgrove has indicated, is to return the protection of religion to the standard that existed prior to the Smith, U.S. Supreme Court decision in Smith in 1990. So the compelling state interest test, the least restrictive means, would be the standard in Oregon. And we have had sad instances, as Mr. Cosgrove mentioned, as Senator Shields testified, the Sunnyside Methodist Church was horrible in terms of the potential negative impact on religion. For a city hearing officer to attempt to establish a numerical limit on the number of people who could attend a church service was blatantly unconstitutional, and the city government recognized it. But that wasn't before the consternation of the entire religious community in the state of Oregon, a hearing before the city council, hundreds of hours of legal effort involved in trying to interpret the thing, both at a local level and at a national level. And that was followed shortly thereafter, as I recall, by a case out of Southern Oregon, in which the city council attempted to restrict the church as to whether or not it could have weddings and funerals take place at that church. So, I mean, we have had some very sad instances of governmental bodies attempting to restrict religious liberties and freedom. In view of the activity that's occurred in other state legislatures, with the advice of our national legal counsel at the state level to seek religious freedom restoration acts, we would hope that with amendment that this bill could be supported and could work its way through the legislative system and to the governor's desk for signature.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, are you an attorney?
I am. Representative Close.
Thank you. I wonder if you would address my concerns about the compelling government interest on line 15, subsection A. And I want to make it clear, I'm not real supportive of watering that down further, as has been suggested by Mr. Castonia. And I'm thinking of an occurrence that you may be aware of. It was a Supreme Court case about a young man who died in a car wreck, and the state asked for an autopsy. The mother they were of the Jewish faith, which believes that's a desecration of the body, and so she sued. I believe it went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, and I believe that it was this compelling government interest test that was used. So, can you just explain to me how that works,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Close? I'm not an expert in this area, but I have at least investigated in the sense of religious freedom. Compelling interest of the state is the same kind of test used in free speech cases. So, for example, an analogy is, it is a compelling state interest to protect people in a crowded theater, so we do not protect the speech of yelling fire in a crowded theater, is the classic old example. It is a reasonably high test. It's also the same test used for race discrimination in the United States, and that I think gives you an idea that it has to be a significant and important state interest, like protection of child welfare. If a religion said it's our religion to steal, the state clearly would have a compelling state interest to nonetheless enforce its anti-theft laws. But with respect to things like autopsies, and I'm not sure the result of that case, I would think the state might have a difficulty, unless there were some very unusual facts, saying why the state has a compelling interest to force an autopsy on an individual person.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Castagna, can you respond to the earlier testimony that this bill is not necessary?
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, from the advice that the Oregon Catholic Conference has received from the Office of General Counsel, United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, their advice to my office and to the office of other state Catholic conferences across the country is advice to pursue this type of legislation at the state level. We have been so advised to seek RFRA statutes.
Chairman Doyle, I think the answer came from one thing that the law professor said. He said that all the 1990 Oregon Supreme Court case that eventually went to the U.S. Supreme Court case, the Smith case, was based on federal law. A later 1995 Oregon Court of Appeals or Supreme Court case said in this area we were going to adopt the lower federal standard for religious freedom. So if you're talking about getting back to where we were before 1990, we need to do it. The Oregon Constitution is not enough. The statute is needed. I hope that answers your question.
Okay, thank you. I guess other questions of this? This too? We'll just have another minute here. So
depends on how much time. I just wanted to have a response to the timing of this bill with terrorism worldwide, and what impact would this have on there are certain religions that certainly view the U.S. and its capitalistic and secular society as the enemy, as you know, very anti. Against our way of life is against the way they live in with their religious beliefs.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Moses Anderson, I think the clearest way to answer that is the primary responsibility for military and international affairs rests with the federal government. The federal government is currently subject to exactly these standards, and I don't think there's been any question that it has had no problem carrying out its safety responsibilities nonetheless.
Okay, thank you. And thank you for your testimony. Representative Hunt, just to clarify, I think, on the status of this, it sounds like there are some proposals on amendments that might be worth considering, and it would seem to me that if you could work with the panelists that have spoken on this, and including ACLU and then also the governor's office, just to see where that might take us to get something moving. And my advice is to do it as fast as you can so we can get something out of here as quickly as we can. So that will close our public hearing on House Bill 3586. And colleagues, just before we take off, last week we had a vote that Representative Flores has asked to vote on. So I will move the rules be suspended for the purpose of allowing Representative Flores to cast her vote on passage of House Bill 2378, which was heard last Thursday. It will not change the outcome of the vote. Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Flores, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
So Flores votes aye. And that concludes our hearing today, and we are adjourned.